Rock the Lakefront June 13th and 14th as Racine Harbor Fest returns for two unforgettable days of live music, mouthwatering food, and nonstop fun. Advance tickets $8, VIP tickets still available online at racineharborfest.com.
Blue Origin has scrubbed this morning's scheduled launch of its Shepard spacecraft from West Texas because of high winds. Six environmental advocates will have to wait for their chance at a quick suborbital flight. A new launch date has not been set yet. It'll be Blue Origin's 13th human flight and 33rd launch overall. Israel says it has struck Iran's Ifhasan nuclear facility a second time and killed three Iranian commanders. Iran launched a new wave of missiles and drones. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi.
Iran is ready to consider diplomacy once again.
But he says Iran will not negotiate with the U.S. until the Israeli attacks stop. CBS's Christian Benavidez says talks in Switzerland failed to produce a breakthrough.
Diplomatic efforts are ongoing in Geneva, led by European leaders. They're trying a last shot at convincing Iran to limit its nuclear program. What's unclear is if that means embracing President Trump's offer for direct talks. Iran called those off after U.S. ally Israel started bombing. On Friday, the president expressed concerns about Iran's potential nuclear capabilities.
And I think within a matter of weeks, or certainly within a matter of months, they're going to be able to have a nuclear weapon. We can't let that happen.
Part of the proposal by European leaders includes the return of UN inspectors, that the U.S. have a role in overseeing Iran's ballistic missile program, and to cut funding to proxies in the region, Hezbollah and the Houthis.
CBS News national security contributor and former Homeland Security official Samantha Vinograd.
In the public statements coming out of negotiations on Friday, it did not look like there was a lot of progress in getting Iran to agree to give up its nuclear program and to give away any and all capability to enrich uranium, even for what Iran claims to be for civilian purposes. However, I would imagine that in addition to the more public-facing negotiations, there are also secret back channels, and we don't have insights into what's happening there, and that's where I would imagine the real meaty discussions are taking place.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from stopping Harvard University from enrolling international students. A judge has freed Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil from an ICE detention facility in Louisiana. The pro-Palestinian protest organizer spent more than 100 days in federal custody.
Justice prevailed, but it's long, very long overdue. This shouldn't have taken 3 months.
The Trump administration will appeal his release. The man who allegedly showed up at the home of Memphis Mayor Paul Young with a taser, rope, and duct tape has been charged with attempted kidnapping and stalking. Police say Trenton Abston told them he planned to confront the mayor about crime in Memphis. The mayor was not home at the time. Abston allegedly scaled a fence to get into the mayor's subdivision. No one was injured in the incident. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shally Pittman. The Wisconsin DNR is investigating a manure spill from Bruggen Dairy Farm in Monroe County. The spill killed hundreds of fish and contaminated healthy waters frequented by fishers. For more, here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
State officials are investigating a manure spill in Monroe County that polluted at least 8 miles of waterways in southwest Wisconsin, killing hundreds of fish and contaminating Spring Valley Creek, Moore Creek, and the Kickapoo River. A massive rain event triggered the runoff from Bruggen Dairy Farm, a 600-head dairy operation near Norwalk. Ben Uvas with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says the farm took measures to protect the soil, but the combination of intense rain and recent manure application caused it to spill into nearby water.
Very localized and a very high intensity rainfall event hit that field, and that was what moved manure off the field down into concentrated flow channels, grass waterways, and eventually off the field into Spring Valley Creek.
The spill was reported through an anonymous tip line to the Wisconsin DNR last month. Hundreds of fish were killed, including prized trout habitats. Farmers apply manure to their fields as fertilizer, but overapplication can cause risks for drinking water and local wildlife. The dairy operation treated about 130 acres of farmland, with nearly 1,200 gallons of manure per acre, which is within the DNR's acceptable standards. There have been at least 9 documented manure spills in Wisconsin this year. A 2022 investigation found that more than 1,500 miles of waterways and 33 lakes in Wisconsin are impaired due to manure and commercial fertilizer pollution. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. This story was produced with original reporting from Nina Elkady for Sentient. For Civic Media News, I'm Shali Pittman.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunny and hot today, highs in the mid-90s. Heat index pushes over 103. Southwest winds up to 35 miles per hour. Heat warnings will remain in effect through Monday. For Sunday, sunny and hot with a high near 95, heat index 99.
Right now, it's 80.
Jay Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Civic Media News Director Charlie Pittman joins us to cover all the weekend news. And then we're talking ticks in hour number two with entomologist PJ Leash, the bug guy. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11. Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are spending all of our time, virtually all of our time, on this weekend broadcast talking about some of the major Supreme Court cases issued this past week, including this landmark decision, a case called Scrimeti, takes its name from the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, in which Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for 6 members of the Supreme Court, himself and 5 others, decides that the state ban coming out of Tennessee that prohibits medical treatments for transgendered youth can, in fact, stand, as can presumably the laws in more than 20 other states in the United States of America, noting in great detail that a lot of the scientific evidence that he has rallied, specifically a report from overseas, suggests that the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in this area is evolving. And for that reason, because in his words, it is uncertain and unclear, it is best to leave these decisions to the legislatures, not matters for the courts to decide. And so he concludes his many-page, 24-page opinion, authored on behalf of virtually all of the members deciding against the challengers in this case, concludes that opinion by saying this. We recite, he says, those overseas reports and others, not for guidance that they may provide on the ultimate question of United States law. In other words, we're not going to decide the ultimate issue of who is actually right or wrong about the medical history and even arguably the legal implications of that. But rather, he says, to demonstrate the open questions regarding basic factual issues before medical authorities and other regulatory bodies. He says, such uncertainty affords little basis for judicial responses in absolute terms, and the calculus of effects, the manner in which a particular law reverberates in a society, is a legislative and not a judicial responsibility. He finishes up his opinion this way. He says, this case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific policy debates once again about the safety and efficacy and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field. The voices in these debates, he writes, raise sincere concerns. The implications for all are profound. The Equal Protection Clause, again, the basis upon which this challenge is made, does not resolve those disagreements, nor does it afford us, he says, license to decide them as we see best. Our role is not to judge the wisdom, fairness, or logic of the law before us, but only to ensure that it does not violate the equal protection guarantee of the 14th Amendment. He concludes this way. Having concluded it does not, we leave questions regarding its policy to the people, again, their elected representatives, and the democratic process. And so orders on behalf of a majority of the Supreme Court, many of whom, again, have written concurrences, joining in much of what he has written, also adding on their own perspectives, finding in the end that the Tennessee law can indeed stand. Can stand not only for Tennessee, but presumably for those well over 20 other states in our nation that have enacted similar kinds of legislation. Now, we know well that in addition to the majority opinion, there is also a scathing dissent. And it is written principally by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. We also have an addendum to that, if you will, by Elena Kagan. She, of course, writes this dissent criticizing her conservative colleagues to uphold that state ban. She is obviously of the different view on medical treatments for transgendered youth. She says that the justices on the other side have retreated from what she calls meaningful judicial review exactly when it matters most. She adds that the court abandons transgender children and their families to political whims. Significantly, and this happens from time to time, when a Supreme Court justice, typically in dissent, sometimes in the majority, feels very strongly about their position, they will read their dissent, they'll read their concurrence from the bench during the opinion announcement, and that happened this past Wednesday when Sonia Sotomayor took the bench, a fairly rare but not unknown step, but a situation typically reserved to emphasize a justice's, that jurist's, extraordinary displeasure with the decision. And so she read her opinion out loud. She took great issue with Justice John Roberts' view that questions about these medical treatments should be resolved only by the legislature. And she writes in her own 31-page dissent that judicial scrutiny has, in this case, long played an essential role in guarding against efforts by lawmakers, as she has described it, to impose upon individuals the state's views about how people of a particular sex or race should live or act. And again, citing cases from the past, we saw that the Chief Justice cited the Loving case having to do with opposite race marriage. She also cites another case. It's called United States versus Virginia, a 1996 case in which the court struck down the Virginia Military Institute's male-only admissions policy, along with Loving versus Virginia, which is the 1967 case that once again declared state laws prohibiting that interracial marriage unconstitutional. About all of those discriminatory policies and laws, Justice Sonia Sotomayor writes, she says those laws, too, posed politically fraught and contested questions about things like race and sex and biology. In the interracial marriage case, again, that both she and the Chief Justice cite, she wrote, as an example, Virginia has argued that if the court intervened in the matter, it would find itself in a bog of conflicting scientific opinion about the effects of interracial marriage and the desirability of preventing such alliances from the physical, biological, genetic, anthropological, cultural, psychological, and sociological point of view. This dissent was fully joined again by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, in part by Elena Kagan. And although justices often conclude their dissents by writing respectfully, in the essay explaining her dissent, she wrote, In sadness, I dissent. Again, she is hearkening back to those other civil rights cases in which there has been concern at the time of a decision about the kinds of things that might be out there, not only in literature, but also about the effects in society of various physical, biological, anthropological issues, and says we've got that here as well. It doesn't mean, she says, that the Supreme Court should be reluctant to find that there is indeed an equal protection argument here and a compelling one. She writes this in particular. Tennessee's ban applies no matter what the minor's parents and doctors think, with no regard for the severity of the minor's mental health conditions or the extent to which treatment is medically necessary for an individual child. The stories of the plaintiffs in this case reflect the states of that harsh reality. And she describes in great detail some of the individuals who are affected by this particular legislation. She describes him as Ryan Rowe, who's now 16, LW, just by the initials there, and also others in this line of individuals whose stories made a part of the petitions to the court. All of that presented in her very extensive and fairly scathing dissent. She goes on to say this: what does this mean in practice? She says simply that sex determines access to covered medication. And she says physicians in Tennessee can prescribe hormones and puberty blockers to help a male child, but not a female child, look more like a boy. And to help a female child, but not a male child, look more like a girl. She goes on to write, put in the statute's own terms, doctors can facilitate consistency between an adolescent's physical appearance and the, quote, normal development of her sex identified at birth. But they may not use the same medications to facilitate inconsistency with sex. All of this, Sonia Sotomayor writes, the state openly admits in service of encouraging minors to appreciate their sex. And once again, like the Chief Justice, she's invoking the legislative history that justified this in the beginning. Interestingly, she spends a lot of time talking about the case that we have also discussed here on this broadcast and others of Civic Media. That's the case of Bostock versus Clayton County way back in 2020, about 5 years ago. You may recall that that is the Title VII case in which the Supreme Court, written by Justice Neil Gorsuch in the majority, found that indeed the protections against employment discrimination applied indeed to everybody in the LGBTQIA community. And she describes the ways in which the Bostock principles also apply here. She says, by depriving adolescents of hormones and puberty blockers only when such treatment is inconsistent with a minor's sex, the law necessarily deprives minors identified as male at birth of the same treatment it tolerates for an adolescent identified as female at birth, and vice versa. And that is her argument, that the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment has indeed been violated. She goes on to take on the majority. She says the problem with the majority's argument is that the very medical purpose the law prohibits is defined by reference to the patient's sex. Key to whether a minor may receive puberty blockers or hormones is whether the treatment facilitates the medical purpose of helping the minor live or appear inconsistent with the minor's sex. That, she says, that, she writes, is why changing a patient's sex yields different outcomes under the law. Again, take the adolescent distressed by newly developing facial hair. Was the patient identified female at birth? The law authorizes the prescription of medication. Male at birth? The law prohibits it. And for truly sex-neutral law, she says, it is impossible to imagine a single scenario where changing a patient's sex yields a different result. To borrow, she writes, from the majority's catalog of apparently benign medical use distinctions, imagine Tennessee allowed consumption of Dayquil to ease coughs, but not minor aches and pains. The regulated medical purpose, treatment of coughs and aches and pains, she writes, are unregulated and unrelated to sex. So a patient's sex will never determine whether she can consume Dayquil. All that matters is whether the patient has a cough. So too for other instances, which she also defines in her extensive dissent in this case. In the end, she writes this: transgender people have long been subject to discrimination in healthcare, employment, and housing, and to rampant harassment and physical violence. She goes on to write this: individuals whose gender identity diverges from their sex identified at birth, whether labeled as transgender at the time or not, moreover, have been subject to a lengthy history of discrimination in the form of cross-dressing bans, police brutality, and anti-sodomy laws. She goes on to say that beginning in 1843, cities ranging from major metropolitan centers like Chicago and Los Angeles to small cities and towns including Cheyenne, Wyoming, and those in South Dakota, enacted ordinances that most commonly criminalized any person appearing upon any public street or other public place in a dress not belonging to his or her sex. In any event, those searching for more evidence of this discrimination against transgender individuals need look no further than the present. When we come back, we're going to conclude our discussion of Sonia Sotomayor's dissent and then move on to some other cases also decided this past week by the United States Supreme Court. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to 540 WAUK, Milwaukee's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. For the last few months, Governor Tony Evers has said repeatedly that he would make a decision about whether or not to run for a third term after the state budget process is completed. In a recent opinion column at the Recombobulation Area, I made the argument that the decision that Evers should make should be to not seek a third term as Wisconsin's governor. This argument is not one of ideological differences or policy disagreements. Tony Evers has been a good governor and has served the state well. This more has to do with Evers' age. He'll be 75 years old in November 2026, and about how the Democratic Party has had a massive, inescapable problem in its unwillingness to pass the torch to the next generation. Tony Evers needs to do what so many other Democrats have struggled so mightily to do and step aside when the time is right. And after Joe Biden's catastrophic 2024, this is a conversation we need to be having, and we need to be having it now. Democrats can't keep repeating the same mistakes over and over. It's time to do things differently.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area. Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Dr. Kristen Lyerly joins us now.
Three in four people have no idea that the hospital I work at in northern Minnesota will likely close if this big, beautiful bill passes, as will the hospital in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. So it is incumbent upon us to have these conversations with each other, not in a hostile way, but in a genuine way about our values and the things that we deeply care about.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
I'm Tony Goldwyn. As an actor and a director, I attend a lot of screenings. But there's one that's different. It's important, and it could save your life. A lung cancer screening. You know, I lost my mom to lung cancer when she was just 68 years old. Screenings help diagnose lung cancer early when it's most treatable, even curable. A quick low-dose CT scan is all it takes. GoTo for lung cancer is your go-to. Visit goto.org.
Being blind doesn't look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support.
Learn more at fightingblindness.org, a public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are appropriately spending virtually all of our broadcast this weekend talking about the United States Supreme Court and this landmark case. It's called Scrimeti. It's spelled S-K-R-M-E-T-T-I, named after the Attorney General for the state of Tennessee. Lots of vigorous dispute between the dissenters, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and majority led by the Chief Justice, who writes an opinion that once again finds that the Tennessee law and laws in other states that prohibit the application, the use, the invocation of various medications and health treatments for transgender youth, the prohibitions can in fact stand because those are matters relegated to and that remain in the purview of the legislature. Needless to say, Sonia Sotomayor strongly disagrees with that, identifies many arguments in the opposite direction. And a part of the debate, a part of the contest between the Chief Justice and Sonia Sotomayor is again about the level of review. It is significant to note that at the core of the majority's opinion is this notion that this transgender health ban should be subject not to a higher level of scrutiny, but rather a rational basis review. That is, whether or not the law rationally advances some identified purpose of the legislature, of the state, in promoting the safety, the health, the welfare of the community that it serves. Sonia Sotomayor encourages a higher review because of the nature of the rights and interests that are at stake here. And she specifically takes on the Chief Justice, who does not adopt this higher level of review, by saying this. She says the majority's choice to avoid applying intermediate scrutiny is all the more puzzling because this court doesn't even have to resolve these questions or wade into what it dubs, again quoting, the fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving fear. That indeed will be the language, the terminology that will animate the discussion about this opinion going forward. She goes on to say that the lower court, the Sixth Circuit, from which this case came, that is the appellate division, the appellate court coming out of the district court in Tennessee, the Sixth Circuit never even asked whether the challenged sex classification in the law serves some important governmental objectives or is substantially related to the achievement of those objectives. She says even the rational-based analysis is not met here. She says all the United States requested of this court was confirmation that intermediate scrutiny applied. On remand, the courts, she says, could have taken account of the recent developments that, according to the majority, underscore the need for legislative flexibility in this area, goes on to write, as she does in the last lines of her dissent, including a recent report from England's National Health Service on the use of puberty blockers and hormones to treat transgender minors. Yet, she says, the majority inexplicably refuses to take even the modest step of requiring Tennessee to show its work before the lower courts. Finally, she says this. This case presents an easy question whether the law's ban on certain medications applicable only if used in a manner inconsistent with sex contains a sex classification. She goes on to write, because sex determines access to the covered medications, it clearly does. Yet the majority refuses to call a spade a spade. Instead, Sonia Sotomayor writes, it obfuscates a sex classification that is plain on the face of this statute, all to avoid the mere possibility that a different court could strike down the law or categorically healthcare bans like it. The court's willingness, she writes, to do so here does irrevocable damage to the Equal Protection Clause and invites legislatures to engage in discrimination by hiding blatant sex classifications in plain sight. It also authorizes, without second thought, untold harm to transgender children and the parents and families who love them. That's Sonia Sotomayor writing, obviously, in strong opposition to what the majority has done this past week in connection with the Equal Protection Clause and specifically with the transgender rights issue before the court this term. Significantly, of course, this is not the end of this discussion. Plainly, in the wake of this opinion of just this past week, we're going to see an awful lot of other courts addressing applications of this. One of the issues is whether or not the Supreme Court has now identified, carved out, if you will, a special group of people for whom there is or may not be protections under the Equal Protection Clause. How does that play out? And indeed, that is some of what animates Justice Sotomayor's concern about the future. Others, of course, have come down in the opposite direction. The Attorney General of the United States of America said on social media this past week that she would, in fact, encourage other states to follow Tennessee's lead and enact similar legislation to protect our kids. And what goes on to say, of course, that this is the kind of thing that the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, would advocate for. Of course, completely contrary to what the Attorney General and the Biden administration and the Justice Department generally had asked the Supreme Court to do at the time that this case was initially before the Supreme Court. Lots more to discuss here. Many more issues in connection not only with transgender rights, but the Equal Protection Clause. Many, many other pieces of litigation going to flow from this opinion of just this past week. And of course, as always, we will take not only a look at those report on those to you and do analysis of exactly what it is that the lawyers say and ultimately what the courts say about the rule of law in America. Scrimeti, a major decision issued by the Supreme Court just this past week. This past week, Wednesday, the Supreme Court issued decisions in four other cases as well. And those cases involve other issues also important to the future and the life and the livelihood of our nation. When Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about those briefly and then talk about future cases on the docket.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation. 540 WAUK.
CBS News Brief. That Blue Origin flight set for this morning with private tourists was scrubbed due to high winds. Now to Iran, where the foreign minister says a negotiated end to the conflict with Israel is still possible if Israel pauses missiles and bombs.
Iran is ready to consider diplomacy once again.
Mahmoud Khalil, that former Columbia University student the Trump administration tried to deport over his pro-Palestinian protest, is free from a federal immigration center.
Justice prevailed, but it's long, very long overdue. This shouldn't have taken 3 months.
In Memphis, relatives of a man accused of trying to kidnap Mayor Paul Young are speaking out after his court appearance. CBS's Nicole Valdez has more.
His family telling reporters he was remorseful and said, quote, I wish I had done something a little different.
The suspect jumped a fence and knocked on Young's door, and police say he had duct tape and rope. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Baseball in the Twin Cities. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Game 2 of the Brewers series this weekend against the Twins going on today. Last night, the Brewers' win was one for the record books. Milwaukee winning by a final score of 17-6 over Minnesota. 23-year-old Jacob Mizorowski, they call him the Miz, in only his second start in the major leagues, pitched a perfect game, a no-hitter, until the seventh inning when the first hit of the game from the Twins was a two-run homer. Mizorowski asked, did it feel like a special night?
Yeah, I mean, it was awesome. I mean, coming out and hearing the crowd cheering like that on a road series, it's exciting. It's awesome.
Did you feel any different emotionally or just how you were able to manage the day and your stuff once you were out there?
I think honestly I felt calmer and ready to go compared to the first one. You know, nerves were going pretty heavy on the first one, so it's good to finally feel the feet under you.
Again, the final from last night, 17-6 in favor of the Brewers. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunny and hot today, highs in the mid-90s. Heat index pushes over 103. Southwest winds up to 35 miles per hour. Heat warnings will remain in effect through Monday. For Sunday, sunny and hot with a high near 95, heat index 99.
Right now, it's 80.
Keeping you connected to your local community with good news and great conversation. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
If you think you know the story behind Summerfest, you may be surprised to learn this. Summerfest didn't start on Milwaukee's lakeshore. Opening to the booms from an air show, the nine-day event in July of 1968 also included car races, soccer matches, and of course, music of all sorts. It was held at more than 35 different locations across the city. Research shows the first several years didn't make money, but rather than give up, organizers moved everything to what had been a 15-acre Cold War missile site and airport along Lake Michigan. This big decision to find a permanent site in the 1970s grew to what's known as the Big Gig, and now runs the next three weekends, noon to midnight. More history and information right here next week, and event details at summerfest.com. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
Matt Nair on air.
From articles that I have seen, if you are a bagel purist, you should not toast your bagel. I think nothing's better than a toasted bagel and a schmear.
Folks, can we have a moment of honesty? Do you really like bagels, or do you like the schmear that is transported by them? Get rid of the stigma. If I walk into this room eating cream cheese out of a tub with a spoon.
Why is that wrong?
Matt Nair on air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Mommy, can I sit in the front seat just this one time? Please, please, please.
No, not yet.
But why?
Because I love you, and you're just not ready yet. Now, get in the back so I can get you in your car seat, please.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Love protects. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from Madison, where I welcome the Green Bay Automobile Gallery's Daryl Burnett. And we rank our all-time favorite summer blockbuster movies. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for the remaining segments of this weekend broadcast, all about the United States Supreme Court. Appropriately spending most of our time talking about this major decision in Scrimeti. Lots of discussion certain to follow in America and beyond, not only about the medical support or lack of support for this position, but also the implications for the Equal Protection Clause in the United States of America. Supreme Court issued five decisions on Wednesday of this past week. Let's talk about some of those as well. Equally important to the areas in which the cases are focused, including the environment, and indeed, prisoner rights as well. Let's talk first about that particular case. Probably not grabbing the headlines that we think about with respect to other major opinions issued by the Supreme Court, but a case called Pertue, P-E-R-T-T-U versus Richards, a case under something called the Prison Litigation Reform Act. It requires prisoners with complaints about prison conditions to exhaust their available grievance procedures before filing something in federal court. And again, here we have a petitioner who has done just that. The Supreme Court takes a look at the procedural aspects of this case and finds in the end that parties are entitled to a jury trial on PLRA exhaustion, that is, whether or not they have exhausted all of their lower remedies, when that issue is a mixed one, when it's intertwined with the merits of a claim that requires a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment. Lots to unpack there, lots, of course, to focus on. But basically, when you've got a mixed case question, the Supreme Court saying that indeed petitioners, in this case prisoners, can in fact and do indeed and are entitled to a jury trial when you've got a mixed question like that. The Seventh Amendment, of course, says in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Basically, an affirmation there in the Seventh Amendment of a jury trial right. And so it's an affirmation this past week under the PLRA of the right of prisoners pursuing their claims against their jailers and other officials to have a jury trial when it comes to mixed questions of law. In fact, they've done that in other areas, including a lot of sentencing cases as well, where there's both a legal issue to be addressed and also a factual issue to be addressed. What we have there in this case, Pertue versus Richards, is an exposition and a reaffirmation of that fundamental principle. Interestingly, in this particular case, we get a mix of justices buying into and supporting that. The Chief Justice, once again, writes that opinion. He delivers the opinion of the court. And here are the justices who support that. Justice Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Jackson join in that. The justices filing dissenting opinions are Justices Barrett and Thomas, Alito, and Kavanaugh. So you've got a very mixed court and a somewhat mixed disposition on this. Nonetheless, the majority holds, finding that indeed petitioners, like those in the Purdue case, are in fact entitled to a jury trial for mixed questions of law and fact. There are three other cases also decided by the Supreme Court, and they are equally interesting in their own ways. All of the 65 cases being decided by the Supreme Court this term, important, hugely significant for the petitioners themselves, but also for the very positions and legal postures that they articulate. Let's talk about one involving nuclear waste. Let's get back and figure out where this comes from. First, the case is called Nuclear Regulatory Commission versus Texas. And that's right, you've got a challenge between an agency of the federal government and some individual states. Where do we get this from? How does this case evolve? The Atomic Energy Act, 1954, that's the genesis for all of us. It prohibits private possession of nuclear materials, including spent nuclear fuel, without a license. Makes perfect sense. Goes on to say that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, again, according to the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, can still license the possession of nuclear materials subject to certain statutory and procedural requirements. Here, there's an entity called Interim Storage Partners, or ISP, that applied for a license to build a facility in West Texas to store spent nuclear fuel. And during the ISP's licensing procedures in front of the NRC, what happens is that a Texas government agency also submits comments about the propriety of that, including on a draft environmental impact statement that was prepared by the commission for this proposed facility, again, positing some nuclear fuel in this special location. There are entities called Fasken Land and Minerals, that's a private West Texas business, and others that also submitted comments and also seeking to intervene in this licensing procedure about where, in fact, the nuclear waste should be deposited, the nuclear fuel should be spent, and going back fundamentally to the notion of process for doing all this, how is this to come about? The commission denied the petition to intervene by Fasken Land and Minerals, and Fasken then unsuccessfully challenged that denial to intervene before the full commission, and yes, indeed, ultimately went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. What happens is this ultimately gets to the United States Supreme Court. It was argued back in March of this year. And interestingly, as the Supreme Court often does in this case, Supreme Court once again says that basically there's a standing problem. It says because Texas, the state, and others, including Fasken, were not parties to the commission's licensing proceeding. They submitted comments, but not a part of the proceeding itself. They are, according to the Supreme Court, not entitled to obtain judicial review of the commission's licensing decision. Goes on to say that under the thing called the Hobbs Act, you probably know that well, the Congress specified that only a party aggrieved by a licensing order of the commission may seek judicial review. In this case, the Supreme Court rules, Texas and Fasken argue that they qualify as parties because they participated by submitting comments on the draft and by attempting to intervene. But the text of the Atomic Energy Act indicates that one must be the license applicant or successfully intervene in the order to obtain party status in the commission licensing proceeding. Based upon the straightforward application of that law, the Supreme Court says these states and these particular entities are out of luck. They cannot challenge, therefore, what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has done in this licensing for the depositing of nuclear fuel. In this particular case, interesting once again that Justice Kavanaugh delivers the opinion of the court, and he is joined in that by Chief Justice Roberts and also by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan and Barrett and Jackson. And Justice Gorsuch files a dissenting opinion. Justice Thomas and Justice Alito join in that. Again, not strange bedfellows, but it indicates that you do have those cases where opinions of Supreme Court justices differ, as they often do, and differ beyond just so-called partisan perspectives. And here you get a true mix, at least with respect to the majority finding that indeed the particular petitioners here, the states and these individual private entities, cannot contest what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has done. That case, once again, Nuclear Regulatory Commission versus Texas and others, decided by the Supreme Court just this past week. And then we get a couple of other cases, and they proceed pretty much in parallel. They are environmental cases, although they're actually jurisdictional cases, cases that judges and lawyers and administrators love to talk about, because they all have to do with where a particular lawsuit should be brought. In what particular jurisdiction should you go? Into the D.C. Circuit Court? That is the court where most of these cases involving big federal issues are decided. Or can you go to any one of the other 12 circuit courts around the country? Actually, 11 circuit courts. The 12th, of course, is the federal circuit, but typically not the subject, not the appropriate jurisdiction for environmental cases. We've got two cases. One of them is called Environmental Protection Agency versus Calumet Shreveport Refining. And yes, indeed, you've got it right. It has to do with small refinery exemption petitions that are presented to the federal government. And there's a second case, again, in parallel to that case, called Oklahoma versus Environmental Protection Agency. How does that case get before the Supreme Court? And how are these cases related? How do they interface with each other in connection with important issues? That is, where are these kinds of contests to be decided? In what court are they to be resolved? The Clean Air Act channels challenges to Environmental Protection Agency actions to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia if those actions are, and here's the important language, nationally applicable. In other words, they have some impact around the country, but to a regional circuit if they are locally or regionally applicable. Makes perfect sense, right? If something is nationally applicable, then it should go to the D.C. Court of Appeals. If instead you've got something that's more of a local or regional issue, then the other circuit courts should be the ones that entertain the cases. The Clean Air Act contains an exemption for certain local, regional applicable actions based on determinations of nationwide scope or effect, which can also be brought in the D.C. Circuit. Lots of administrative language here. Once again, it's a lot. The EPA, in this particular case involving Oklahoma and the EPA, aggregated its disapprovals into one omnibus Federal Register rule. And it described EPA's four-step framework for evaluating some submissions made to it under the Clean Air Act. The EPA asserted then in the rule that its disapprovals would be reviewed only in the D.C. Circuit Court as either nationally applicable actions or alternatively as local or regionally applicable actions falling within the nationwide scope or effect exemption in the law. It is very complicated. It's a lot of language and it is a lot of lawyerly manipulation, but it is important because these cases determine where indeed these litigation challenges will be decided. States and industry petitioners challenge the EPA's actions, their disapprovals in regional courts. Of the five circuits resolving the EPA's motions to dismiss or transfer, four found that regional circuit courts reviews were proper. Only the 10th Circuit said otherwise. And so all this comes to the United States Supreme Court. And in the end, in this case, again, the Oklahoma case, what does the Supreme Court do? The Supreme Court says that EPA's disapproval of the Oklahoma and Utah requests are locally or regionally applicable actions reviewable in a regional circuit. Basically saying that indeed that is the way that these cases, that is where these cases can indeed be resolved. The case, once again, Oklahoma versus Environmental Protection Agency, significant as it is in other cases about who decides these cases, how they go in the Supreme Court, and who authors the opinions. When we come back, I'll tell you about that, and then we'll talk about yet another case also in the environmental area as Amicus, a law review, continues.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. Voting Rights Lab reports there were 59 state bills introduced on proof of citizenship for voter registration this year, and 160 bills concerning voter ID. A handful have made it near the finish line, but not all have passed. Since President Donald Trump's baseless accusations of mail-in voting fraud in 2020 and his unfounded claims of widespread non-citizen voting in the 2024 election, Republican-dominated legislatures have raced to pass stricter voter ID and proof of citizenship laws, despite no widespread abuse of either. In New Hampshire, versions of SB 218 were advanced, requiring submission of ID and proof of citizenship for absentee registration, and are now in a committee of conference. In Texas, a high-priority documentary proof of citizenship bill died without action at the end of the session. In Texas alone, there were 15 bills introduced to provide documentary proof of citizenship and 10 tightening voter ID laws. Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo surprisingly vetoed a bipartisan voter ID bill attempting to codify a widely supported ballot initiative. Democrats negotiated expanded ballot drop boxes in exchange for supporting voter ID. His veto statement said the bill did not address implementing voter ID for mail-in ballots. Wyoming and Indiana passed proof of citizenship earlier this year. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Mark Sommerhauser, the communications director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, analyzing the impacts of the big brutal bill.
That number that you mentioned of nearly $15,000 per person, literally about a quarter of the state's economy.
Basically a quarter of the state's economy coming from the federal government. I'm not hearing from Republicans in the state in their biennial budget planning any sort of contingency plan for major disruption in federal funding coming into the state.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m. Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Todd Michaels joins us now.
I have to give a shout out to Oshkosh. It's a very underrated city.
There was also a restaurant there I really liked. I don't think it's there anymore.
Yeah, the Tally's was great. I may have gone to like a prom dinner there or something like that back in my day too, Pete.
A little calzone before you tear it up in the dance floor.
Man, there's nothing better than wearing a tuxedo and a little calzone in your cummerbund.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Here's the deal. We gotta set ourselves up. See, retirement is the long game. We gotta make moves and make them early. Set up goals. Don't worry about a setback. Just save up and stack up to reach them. Let's put ourselves in the right position. Pre-game to greater things.
Start building your retirement plan at thisispretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review talking all about the United States Supreme Court and its five decisions issued just on Wednesday of this past week. All of them important, a couple of them not falling necessarily at the top of our news headlines, but important in the areas of the environment because they focus on where these cases can indeed be brought. In this Oklahoma case versus the EPA, Here is a case where Justice Clarence Thomas delivers the opinion of the court finding that indeed the EPA's disapprovals of the requests by Oklahoma and Utah are in fact locally or regionally applicable and therefore reviewable in a regional circuit as opposed to the District of Columbia. In particular, in that case, Justice Thomas is joined by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan, Kavanaugh and Barrett and Jackson. Justice Gorsuch filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, and Justice Roberts joined in that. Justice Alito took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. That matter ultimately premised, again, the underlying facts, which for purposes of the decision by the Supreme Court are still important. But the question really is, what is the court that's going to decide this? Has to do with each state in this particular case, including Oklahoma, submitting an implementation plan detailing how it would comply with a good neighbor provision under the Clean Air Act, which requires the states to provide adequate provisions prohibiting in-state emissions that would interfere with other states' compliance under the Clean Air Act. That will now be adjudicated, those kinds of issues, in a regional court. Does not have to be in the District of Columbia. In a related case, this other case, Environmental Protection Agency versus Calumet Shreveport Refining, we've got some other underlying facts, and it has to do with the Clean Air Act's renewable fuel program. Most domestic refineries have to blend specified amounts of ethanol and other renewable fuels into transportation fuels that they produce. The Act provides a phased exemption scheme for small refineries, that is, those who are processing no more than about 75,000 barrels of crude oil daily, allowing them to petition the EPA for exemptions based upon the disproportionate economic impact of all of this. So it has to do with small refinery exemptions and an EPA decision that's being challenged plainly by some of those small refineries. Here, once again, the question is whether under the Clean Air Act, these cases are nationally applicable, the issues raised there, and can only be challenged in the D.C. Circuit, or whether they're local and regionally applicable actions that can belong in regional circuits. And once again, the Supreme Court says this: EPA's denial of the small refineries' exemption petitions are locally or regionally applicable actions that fall within the nationwide scope or effect exceptions, requiring venue in the D.C. Circuit. Again, lots of administrative language to unpack there. What it basically means that in this particular case, again, invoking the same kind of language as we saw in the Oklahoma case, here, because of the specific facts and the particular applications of the small refinery and the exemptions that they sought, there is an exception, again, based upon a nationwide scope or effect, requiring venue in the D.C. Circuit. So two different results, applying the law in two different cases, both of them under the Clean Air Act, different underlying facts, different underlying predicates. And here, once again, you have Thomas, Justice Thomas, delivering the opinion of the court, joined in by Justice Alito, by Justice Sotomayor, by Justice Kagan, Justice Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Jackson. Gorsuch filed a dissenting opinion, and Chief Justice Roberts, in this case, joined in that dissenting opinion. So a lot of mix of justices coming down on different sides of these, yes, decisional cases involving where litigation can proceed. Critically important for not only the environmental cases brought under the Clean Air Act, but also for the administrative actions that are a part of these decisions. All of those five cases, including Scrimeti, decided by the Supreme Court just this past Wednesday, and obviously more of that to come in future broadcasts of Amicus Law Review. We have traditionally, at this time of year, also talked about the decisions that the Supreme Court makes, even as it's deciding these major cases, big, small, in between, even as it's resolving these cases, it's also building its docket for the next term of the Supreme Court, which again begins in early October of this year of 2024. goes into 2025. Just this past week, the Supreme Court added two new cases for its next term. Let me tell you a little bit about those. In First Choice Women's Resource Centers versus Platkin, the court agrees to decide whether a group of crisis pregnancy centers that were faith-based nonprofits that hold themselves out as healthcare clinics and frequently provide some material support to pregnant women but try to persuade them not to have an abortion, whether they can go forward to federal court to challenge the constitutionality of a subpoena from a state attorney general, or whether they must instead pursue those claims in state court. So you've got the underlying abortion issue, reproductive rights issue, but really, once again, a procedural issue about whether or not a subpoena and compliance with it issued by a state attorney general, where should that be adjudicated? Where should we argue about that? And the question comes again before the Supreme Court, not to address the reproductive rights issue specifically, although that will plainly loom large, but rather focusing upon the notion that a state or perhaps a federal court will be the one deciding that. Then there's a second case called Chevron USA versus Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana. Supreme Court agreeing to hear a long-running lawsuit brought by Louisiana and its parishes attempting to hold certain oil companies liable for the production of crude oil in the state during World War II. A very interesting case. History, all of that coming up as a part of the next Supreme Court docket. We will be talking about more of the Supreme Court decisions in future editions of Amicus Law Review. Join us in the future weekends for our discussions of all of that and more. Have a good weekend, everybody.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. There's a new round of Israeli strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities as the hostilities between those nations start their second week. Talks in Geneva yesterday between Iran's top diplomat and European foreign ministers did not produce a breakthrough, but Iran's foreign minister says there's still a chance for a negotiated end to the fighting.
Iran is ready to consider diplomacy once again.
CBS's Haley Ott reports that won't happen unless Israel stops attacking.
Missiles over Tel Aviv launched from Iran in the early hours, sending people fleeing to bomb shelters. No casualties were reported, but a fire broke out at an apartment building near the city, and Israel swiftly responded, targeting missile storage and launch infrastructure sites, it said, as well as the Isfahan nuclear site, and killing three Revolutionary Guard commanders.
Mahmoud Khalil, the former